Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, a while back we had a guy on the show named Bill Killeen, who owns a horse ranch in Florida, and we were talking about the horse business, breeding and racing and all that. But Bill is an interesting guy even before that. Long ago, he was the founder and owner of something called the Subterranean Circus in the university town of Gainesville, Florida, from like 1967 all the way up to 1990, okay? So this place was the first real hippie boutique supplying Gainesville's youthful population with all the paraphernalia of the counterculture, you know, posters and peace signs and granny dresses and Nehru jackets and strobe lights and black lights and all that good stuff, sandals, belts, water beds, and what have you. So just naming these things recalls a whole era for those of us old enough to remember it. Bill was the type of hip entrepreneur that every small college town with a big university in it has. You know, towns like Gainesville and like Austin, Texas, and Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Madison, Wisconsin. So, and in general, you know, you get the idea. Kind of a businessman whose creative approach to retail influences the local style and culture of that town in a big way. And because Bill owned this store for so long, he really had a great overview, kind of a catbird seat view of the whole college scene and the way things changed over a couple of generations of college kids, really. So Bill was kind of like a local icon. He helped to sponsor the local music scene, which produced people like Stephen Stills, right, of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Tom Petty, obviously Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And he was also famous for being the publisher of an alternative magazine called The Charlatan first in, I guess, Tallahassee and Gainesville, and then later the producer of a spoof comic strip called Wonder Warthog. So that's kind of a cult classic for those who are into hip cartoons at the time and even later. So he's also, I'll say this out loud here, he's a very witty guy with a lively sense of humor and an excellent writer and raconteur with a satirical style that suits us just fine here in American Variety. So that's why we're here with him today. Welcome, Bill.
Okay, Court, we're ready to go.
Yep. So because the Subterranean Circus ran for parts of three decades, I mean, you really saw it all. I mean, how things changed from the 60s counterculture and what became of it and how it then changed into the, I guess, the me decade of the 70s and whatever they call the 80s, I don't know, the greed decade or something. But we have half an hour. So what we're going to do is talk about those changes. And this is not obviously going to be a sociological tour de force. It's just kind of our conversation back and forth about it and Bill's impressions of what went on. So you started out, Bill, in Austin, Texas, at the University of Texas there. What was that like in the early 60s when you were there?
Well, you've got to remember, back in 1962, when I was at UT and in Austin helping Gilbert Shelton publish the Ranger magazine, you were just pretty much through the beatnik era, you know, and there were no hippies. And in fact, drugs were very difficult to get. People in those days would, lock themselves in the bathroom to smoke a joint.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, things like LSD and speed and cocaine, nobody knew about any of that stuff.
Right.
I remember the first time I ever heard of LSD, Janis Joplin was standing in the bathroom, and she said, "They've got this new stuff, LSD, lysergic acid diethylamide, or whatever the hell it is," and she says, "People are taking this stuff and jumping off of roofs." And I said, "Well, I don't want any of that stuff." She said, "Well, I want some right now."
That sounds good. So
anyway, as time went on and more marijuana was being smoked, the society slowly changed. But back before that, before there was marijuana, there were still people that were trying to get high and trying to have hallucinatory experiences. I remember Gilbert Shelton and Joey Brown and Tony Bell, three guys who were on the Ranger staff, were at Shelton's apartment one day, and what they decided to do was ingest some peyote, which is about the only way you could have a hallucinogenic experience in those days before LSD. So they got these mushrooms and these peyote, and they started to eat them. And it's almost impossible to eat peyote by itself because you'll throw up immediately. So they started putting it in peanut butter, and they were able to get it down. And they were going to keep a record of their experience, this hallucinatory experience, because they had had one before in which great truths were revealed to them under the influence of the peyote.
Oh, yes.
So they had notepads. And at first, the little notepads were fine. They started writing their sentences. And then the words started getting bigger and bigger. And as I recall, just before I took the pad away from Gilbert Shelton, he had an N which filled up the entire thing. So these guys, they were getting loaded on peyote for a while, and then of course grass came along, and it was a pretty long time before, you know, anything else was in there. You got to remember, people in Texas are big drinkers.
Yeah.
Around the rest of the country, when it started becoming hip to smoke marijuana, you know, they started putting down alcohol. Oh, beer, no, you don't want to do that. Just, you know, smoke your dope. Well, the people in Texas never got the message on that. They continue to drink their beer and smoke their marijuana out there.
Yeah, but I would say that at the time you're talking about, which is the early into the mid-60s, that on college campuses, that the group of people you're talking about, Gilbert Shelton, who was a, you know, kind of famous cult cartoonist, and Janis Joplin, who was at the very beginning of just beginning to become Janis Joplin. But still, these were extremely hip avant-garde people. But I would say you're probably a sub-cult, right? The great majority of people were still, I would say, fraternities were still dominant, certainly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
So, I mean, you were...
They were still playing the Kingston Trio things out the front doors of the fraternity houses.
Right, and that was the hip thing, would be, you know, Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley by the Kingston Trio or something. But I was a little boy at the time, and I listened to my parents play it, and I thought it was good. But I mean, so you guys were not only hiding in the closet because marijuana was so illegal that nobody had ever heard of it, but you were hiding in the closet because your group were so ahead of the time there that you were kind of odd men out, right? I mean, you were not part of the mainstream at all.
No, we weren't part of the mainstream. In fact, Janis was looked upon as some kind of a freak, you know. Walked around with her auto harp and her black turtleneck and her black pants, and you know, everybody looked at her like she was somebody from outer space. And the rest of us, although it was a subculture, it was a pretty extensive one. There were probably, you know, 300 or 400 people, which included an awful lot of musicians and magazine people and so on and so forth that belonged to that. And it had a lot of influence because, of course, the magazine was read by, you know, 10,000 to 15,000 students when it came out every month, and they, you know, a lot of them kind of followed in step with what the magazine was doing. But basically, you have an enormous campus, which I don't know how many they had then, probably 40,000 students, and they're very slow to convert, you know. Marijuana sort of was really the tool that got a lot of them going in the other direction.
You know, and this is the University of Texas at Austin, so it's in a very conservative state, and maybe because it's in a very conservative state, Austin has always been a very hip town in that university. Like some of the ones I named at the beginning, are small towns where there's a hip state university where, you know, there's kind of a tendency to be on the frontier a little bit, and Austin has remained that way, but there was probably a lot of resistance back then. But I would say that, to me, the 60s really ran from about 1966 or 67, depending on where you were, through about 1973. It wasn't really, when you say the 60s, you're talking about the counterculture period or the most intense central part of it, and it really wasn't mapped directly onto the 1960s. It was kind of from that period, 66-7, through about 73, so maybe a 6 or 7 year period. Would you say that's roughly true in your observations?
Well, the Summer of Love was the summer of 67 in San Francisco.
Right.
And everybody in California was gradually going in this direction. The state was inundated with people who were either running away from home or, you know, to join some hippie colony, or just, you know, people like Shelton and Janis who said, this is where it's happening and that's where we're going. And gradually what happened is there got to be so many people out there that the services of the cities and counties couldn't take care of them, because most of them weren't working, let's face it. And so the drugs were coming in, the hippies were coming in, and you had groups like the Diggers that was run by a guy named Wavy Gravy. And he started out trying to feed everybody out there, and it just became an impossible thing. The whole hippie thing kind of grew so fast and had so little, you know, logistical support that it just kind of fell in on itself after a while. That and heavier drugs, you know, speed started coming in, and heroin and those things kind of wrecked the whole ideology.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Bill Colleen, who is so old that he remembers the Kingston Trio and the Beatnik period, but he's a very he's a guy who's remained young somehow through all of it, through thick and thin. And so we're talking really about his perceptions, and mine too, of the 60s and a little later here, the way it shifted into the 70s and then the 80s, from his perspective in running, and we'll get to this, a very hip boutique in Gainesville, Florida. But I started off going to college in New York in 1967, in New York State. And Bill, I remember a tremendous sense of exploration of everybody having the feeling of doing things that had never been done before and thinking things that hadn't been thought before, or so we thought at the time, right, being 18 or 19 or whatever. But that early avant-garde phase, which was more the, let's say, the high-end college kids, you know, was exhilarating, but it changed, and you alluded to it a minute ago. I think it changed a lot as drugs became more pervasive and as it went beyond pot into heavier drugs. And as it spread, I mean, I can remember in Gainesville that, what did they call them, the juicers, you know, the people who were not part of this change in culture really hated the long hairs. And there was a whole thing of, you know, if you had long hair, you know, there were songs about that were, you know, kind of detrimental to it. And there was
How about
a feeling
for Muskogee.
Yeah, that kind of thing, you know. So there was a feeling of being isolated in these college towns for a long time. But then it kind of broke through some barrier, and pot and long hair, et cetera, spread to more the, you know, the blue collar groups of young guys and the non-college elite people. And it spread. And I think as that happened, it became focused more on getting stoned and on the sex parts than on the kind of seeking parts, if you want to call it that. Is that sort of in a general way?
Yeah, I think that's valid. Talking about hostility, I mean, I think the fourth day that the Subterranean Circus was open, the night before that, somebody threw a gigantic concrete block through our front glass window, so we ceased to have glass windows in the front after that. Mm-hmm. But what happened with these guys, no matter how straight they were, no matter how antagonistic they were, they started noticing these little hippie girls running around with no bras on and in transparent dresses, and they started thinking, well, gee, you know, and then the whole free love deal came along, and these guys, I'll tell you what, will straighten a straight guy out quicker than anything else. It's the possibility of grabbing hold of one of those hippie girls.
Yeah, that was a factor, too. And, you know, just the general feeling, I think, as the fraternity thing went on, as opposed to the hip thing and the numbers of hip people grew, the fraternity thing clearly began to be sort of reactive and reactionary, and it became the old-fashioned thing that was kind of left behind. And I think there was some sense of the guys who were started out as more the straight fraternity outlook of, gee, well, we better start to adopt at least the outward look of some of these things because we're starting to look real old-fashioned. You know, there was some of that. A lot of it became fashion, too, you know. There was a huge mix. I mean, you had to be there to understand it. Trying to explain all of that to a 20-year-old kid today is really hard, you know.
Sure. Well, the whole hair thing was a big deal. Like, you would never catch a fraternity guy with long hair for a while.
Mm.
It was sort of like watching things spread from California to the East Coast.
Yes.
And California to New York, and then coming from both directions.
That's right.
But in any case, as time goes by, And something becomes more and more popular with women, first of all, and with other people out there, like entertainers and so on and so forth, they take their cues from that.
Mm.
And, you know, then the music was a big deal, too. The music was a very big deal.
Sure.
And nobody wants to be the square guy, you know, so they, you know, a lot of them just fell into it.
Yeah, and so there was like a superficial transition. There was a thing called weekend hippies, remember that? So
sure.
There were people who kind of dressed the part for a while but didn't.
Absolutely.
They kind of, you know, knew the words, but they didn't know how to sing the music, you know. But gradually it did merge where they did learn the music more, you know, and it was kind of a general broadening of that whole thing, but it changed, I think, in a negative direction overall to me after a while, where it got to be more just avoiding responsibility and getting stoned a lot, and that became something that kind of lasted into the 70s a long time. There was also at the time a political undercurrent to the whole thing. It wasn't just social in terms of, you know, the way you dressed and what you did for recreation and entertainment and sex and drugs and so on, but there were two kind of branches to that. There was the anti-war movement that was going on, because all of this was mapped on top of the Vietnam War period. And then there was a general, I would say, radical rejection of the system, right, and the establishment, where you didn't want to be like your parents had been, and there was a whole kind of anti-cultural thing to it. And those were different, and they overlapped, but they were different. So what was your perception of all of that in Gainesville when that was going on?
Well, you're talking about partly the Timothy Leary thing, the tune-in, drop-out deal.
Yeah.
And a lot of people did that. They just decided, okay, just whatever the hell happens, happens. But you had an awful lot of people, too, who are going to be influenced by the possibility of going into the service and having to participate in a war. And so you had a gigantic protest thing based on that. I mean, these days, nobody gets drafted. So, you know, they say, well, what's the matter with the college kids? Well, you're not drafting any of them, so not that worried about going to the war anymore. Back then, they sure were. And so that influenced a lot of people. But sure, you had two different groups of people. You had the people that just didn't want anything to do with society, and you had the other people that were protesting the Vietnam War and raising holy hell, SDS and everybody.
Yeah, so there was kind of a difference in style, in fact, a big difference in style between those two, because the radical leaders would get up on a stage and have a microphone and yell and strut around on the stage and, you know, expect an adoring following and so on. And so that was more an aggressive kind of thing that was counterposed, I think, against the passivity of the real hippie thing, which was kind of just sit around and go groovy, man, you know, and listen to music and not be that exercised about anything one way or the other.
That's right.
Yeah, so there were kind of two different poles, even though they all had long hair or whatever, and from the outside, someone might view them as the same, but they were quite different, really. There were a lot of subcultures to the counterculture, huh?
No doubt about it. I think one thing we're not talking about too much here is the art back in those days. You were talking about how everybody was buzzed with all the possibilities that could happen, and I remember the first time I went into the Infinite Poster in New York to buy some stuff wholesale to bring back to my shop. And I looked at the wall of that thing, and I'll tell you what, there was some beautiful stuff in there going on. There was artists who were coming out of the woodwork, and not just people that were creating posters. There were people that were creating a whole different lifestyle. They were creating clothes, they were creating posters, they were creating, everything was new, you know? I remember when we opened the store, and these Cossack shirts and Nehru shirts and stuff like that were almost unavailable to us to sell, and we could sell billions of them. We finally got about 18 women in the back of our store sewing those things up so that we could make enough to sell not only to our people but to the few people around who had similar shops and, you know, and wanted to buy them so that they could stock the things. And when bell bottoms came in for the first time, we were the first people that had them. We sold so many of those things we couldn't keep track of them. It was a whole different. It's amazing going from how straight everything was in the 50s when nobody questioned authority, including me at first, until I realized when I was at the university that these deans and presidents are kind of corrupt. Everybody started questioning everything, and they started going a completely different direction, you know, with clothes, with the way they thought, with the opposition to authority. And unfortunately, things gradually, the pendulum swung back.
Well, that's why they called it the counterculture. You know, so when you were running this shop, I mean, you were old enough that your personality was already formed by the time all that started. If you were 17 or 18 when all that started, it kind of had a bigger impact on you and made a bigger impression in your whole outlook and so on.
That's right.
But I think you were already kind of looking at the world in a more practical way, even though you were a creative, artistic guy, you know, but you had a business bent and you started a store that became very popular for a long period of time. I mean, you probably were making money in there for a long time. So you were then having to manage employees and so on. Did employees become, over time, much harder to find reliable employees and to manage people? I mean, during the hippie period?
I had that store for 23 years and I ended up firing six people. A couple of them could never manage to come in on time. I remember a couple of them, there was a Bob Dylan concert in town one time, and they said, well, we're supposed to work that night, but we're going to go to the Bob Dylan concert. And I said, well, you know, if you go to the Bob Dylan concert, it's your turn to work, then just don't come back anymore. And so they closed the store at 6 o'clock, went to the Bob Dylan concert, came back the next day, and assumed they would still have their jobs. And I said, I guess you're not listening to me, you know. You're out of here. And they just couldn't believe that the Bob Dylan concert didn't take precedence over, you know, the store being open. And I told them, we're running a business here. When I first opened the store, I was 27 years old. When I first opened the store, I got all these people that came in. Oh, well, this is a hit shop. We got to have a meditation room. And, you know, they're in there wanting to sell drugs and take them in the store. And I said, you know how long this place will be open if I let you guys do what you want? About 10 minutes. The state's attorney's out there just looking for a reason to shut this place down. And so you're right. I had to be a businessman. I was never what I would consider a hippie. I'm not much for just adopting somebody else's entire credo, you know, and going along and saying, well, this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, even opposition to the war and some stuff like that, which I realized that the Vietnam War was a joke and never should have been started. Mm. But there were more arguments than it wasn't just a totally black and white deal, you know. And, yeah, I didn't have much trouble with employees overall because everybody wanted to work there. I mean, who wouldn't want to work there? I mean, everybody was coming in. You kept meeting new people all the time. You were selling stuff that you used yourself. New creations kept coming in all the time. At first, all they had for smoking devices were lamp parts and the bongs, the bamboo bongs that people would bring back from Vietnam. And as time went by, I mean, these people got really creative. We had so much to select from when we went to New York to buy stuff for the store that it was incredible. They used to have a thing in the Hotel McAlpin in New York called the National Boutique Show. Hmm. It was like 11 floors of paraphernalia, clothes, cigarette papers, you name it. And it was a whole crew of people making a living off of this stuff.
So like you said, Bill, you were in the middle of all this, who owned the store that was kind of the mecca of all of this in the Gainesville area, but you weren't really part of it. You were hip but not a hippie, right? So was that tricky to do? I mean, did you have to deal with people? You just described how you fired some people where you'd forewarned them and they didn't really take it seriously. And the ethos of the counterculture would not normally have allowed that. You had to endlessly make allowance for people and forgive, you know, every kind of behavior and not judge, but you still did because you were kind of bringing some of the same basic business mindset that's traditional, you know, to what you were doing there, which is why it succeeded for so many years. But was it tricky to do? Did you have to kind of deal with people in a way that was new to you, or was it all pretty much straightforward and they just kind of towed the line or not?
That's clever of you to have thought of that. Actually, yes, you did have to because you had groups like SDS that considered us capitalists because, you know, we obviously weren't putting a lot of money into their pot. Hmm. And, you had the tremendous majority of the people just loved the stuff because, first of all, we were really attentive to people when they came in. We didn't bother them. We let them mess around, go back and look at the posters, do whatever the hell they wanted. People would come in just to talk, shoot the bull. But then you had the political people, and they were always around, and there's a lot of pretty smart ones, too. Hmm. And they felt like, well, you know, this is a capitalistic enterprise, which capitalism, the people around today don't realize how much antagonism there was to a capitalist.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Dirty word.
But I was just never one of these people that was, you know, got overwhelmed by my need to appease everybody. I just felt like, hey, if you don't like it, stay the hell out. As a matter of fact, that was pretty much a philosophy we had when people came in and, you know, complained about this, that, and the other thing. Hey, you know, we don't need your business. We were just the opposite of Sears and Roebuck. If you came in and gave us a hard time, go somewhere else. We don't care, you know. And I would be a very bad employee in a normal mall store, you know. They just couldn't hire me. I guess I would be a very bad employee in almost any store, come to think of it.
I think you were born to work for yourself and have your own business.
No doubt about that one.
I suspect that's true, Bill. We are talking with Bill Killeen here on American Variety about the 60s and after, and what happened after the 60s. So what did that period change into, Bill, in Gainesville? I mean, how did college students in general change throughout the 70s and 80s? Because you were seeing the same cadre age group of people just constantly shifting in front of you or slowly shifting in front of you during all that long period.
Well, one of the things that happened was cocaine. And cocaine really changed things for a lot of people. Cocaine was sort of the drug of choice for lawyers and doctors and upscale people who could afford it. Mm. And matter of fact, I'll tell you a story. A guy came into my place one time, a little red sports car, probably the thing was worth about $50,000, and he had just smashed up the side of it. He was on his way to the hospital. This guy was a lawyer. He was on his way to the hospital, but he came in the store to get some glass pipes, which he was going to use to freebase. Mm. On the way to the hospital, he came in to pick this stuff up. Mm. So cocaine sort of perverted the whole nice thing, you know. And then freebasing, of course, and that led to crack. And then crack was an available thing, which, you know, mostly blacks had it. But it wasn't only blacks. A lot of whites started getting it, too, because it was inexpensive. And you started getting more diabolical drugs now. You had all the bikers that always used methamphetamines. Hmm. So, you know, that was a prevailing thing, too. Everybody likes speed. You stay up all night. You can go to the beach and watch the sunset. So I think slowly but surely, everything went in the same direction. The drugs got more negative, which is the same thing they did in California. You know, you had that Rolling Stones concert there where people got killed. the clothes started. They had done everything they could think of. Big companies had by now absorbed the smaller companies and creators who had made the other clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And the clothes started gravitating back to the same types of shirts and things you had originally. It was a very slow process. But sooner or later, years went by, you wouldn't even have known the hippie thing ever happened because the clothes are all back like they were before, especially for men.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just a slow process. And everybody just said, woke up one day, especially hippies, and said, hey, what happened? You know, what happened to all the hippies? Where'd all the hippies go? Well, it was a gradual process where, you know, people decided free love didn't really work. Communes, for the most part, didn't really work. And, you know, all the things that they experimented on, for the most part, didn't really work. So they went in another direction, most of these people.
Did they really revert back totally to the 50s, or was there kind of a blending of, you know, a better,
no,
big, broader outlook or something? I mean, it wasn't that uptight as the 50s anymore.
No, I don't think they'll ever go back to the 50s, because
yeah.
the 50s was an unquestioning era
yeah.
where everybody just believed the president would never do anything wrong and the mayor would never do anything wrong. And it was just a total trust in authority, you know, post-war people. And the people that I was with, okay, we've got a thing in Austin called the Ghetto Line, which because I spent a little bit of time in Austin, I'm a part of. This is like a 24-hour ongoing conversation among people who were in Austin in the early 60s. Everybody now, obviously, is 70 and above. These people have all retained their liberal notions from years ago. A lot of other people that I see have gone completely in the other direction, and there's plenty of them in the middle. But I think all of them were influenced by the use of marijuana. All of them, all of the ones I know anyway, still feel like marijuana should be legalized, which I do too. They feel like there should be no law against it, people shouldn't be in prison, so on and so forth. So yeah, there's been that influence, yeah.
Well, we're near the end of the show, Bill. Just quickly, which era from the early 60s to 1990 or so did you like the best?
Well, I was almost just a post-adolescent in 1962 when I lived in Austin. And even though I only lived there for 6 or 7 months, I just seemed like I discovered something new there every day. You know, it was just a brilliant time. I was developing as a writer. I was around people who were smarter than me, basically. I was learning about music. That's my favorite time. But then again, the time that we opened the store and that whole summer of love thing began erupting, that was terrific also.
I think it's fair to say that for everybody who goes to college, that's got to be a memorable time and a favorite time in their life that sticks out, because everything's new and you're away from your parents' influence to a great extent, and you're learning new things, and the world is new, and it's all future laid out ahead of you there. So Bill writes a weekly column on his blog called The Flying Pie, Universal Truths Which Transcend Mere Accuracy. And I recommend that you go to it. It's www.billkilleen.com. billkilleen.blogspot.com, or just look up The Flying Pie Killeen and you'll find it. He's a really good writer. It's satirical, it's funny, he's very literate, and he ranges all over the map in terms of what he talks about. A lot of it's horses, for that matter, too. So it's a hoot. I recommend that you give it a try. Bill, thanks so much for being on with us on American Variety and talking about the good old days of the 60s and after.
Well, thank you, Cord. It was a lot of fun remembering these things.
I appreciate all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.